All right, this is United States of America versus Safe House et al., a civil matter, 19-519. Would counsel please identify themselves for the record?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Bill McSwain of the United States. I have with me Greg David, Aaron Lindgren, and Brian Hughes.
Counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Alana Eisenstein on behalf of Safe House and Jose Benitez. I have with me Rhonda Goldfein, Megan Krebs, Ben David Blassen, and the remainder of the Safe House litigation team.
Counsel, thought I would begin today's proceeding with sort of a review of what I said at the last proceeding, which is to say that what's pending before this court is a fairly narrow and technical legal issue, and that is the application of a federal criminal statute to a particular course of conduct. The issue before me is not whether it's good public policy. The issue before me is not whether it's good public health. This is certainly not a zoning issue, where I am to decide where such a facility should be if it were lawful. My job here is to apply a statute to a set of facts. We held an evidentiary hearing earlier, and most of that hearing addressed these broader questions of public policy and public health. In fact, it overwhelmingly addressed those issues rather than the narrow statutory issue that's in front of the court. And I think for purposes of public debate, perhaps that's a useful exercise. For purposes of the issue before me, I've concluded that no testimony of any witness should be considered in resolving this motion because it is a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And for the non-lawyers present, what that means is the government has filed a case and made certain allegations. Safe House has answered and made certain allegations. And I'm being asked to accept all of those facts as true, no dispute as to the facts, without having evidence or having a trial, and then make a legal ruling based upon the stipulated facts of the parties. And so for these purposes, I will not consider the testimony at the hearing, although certainly I got some flavor of the arguments from the hearing. I had mentioned to counsel when we had a recent discussion that they should assume the court would be well-versed in the statute and the applicable legal principles. And in fact, I think a lot of what I want to do today, counsel, is to discuss with you questions that have occurred to us and issues that we think are potentially relevant or important, cautioning everyone not to try to read anything too much into any particular line of inquiry or any particular question. And those lawyers in the room will know how difficult it is to ever understand where a case may be going. And if people are saying, well, which way is the judge leaning? Well, the judge is worried about getting it right. And so the questions here are questions that are important to me in grappling with the complicated issues in front of me. The government has brought the motion for judgment on the pleadings, and so they have the laboring oar. And so who's going to argue on behalf of the government?
I will, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. McSwain. You can stay at counsel table if you like or come to the podium, wherever you're more comfortable, because a lot of what I'm going to be doing today is asking you questions, all right? So it might make sense to be at counsel table if you're more comfortable there, but approach the podium if you so desire.
Thank you, Your Honor. I prefer the podium.
Wherever you're comfortable.
May it please the court, counsel, Bill McSwain of the United States. Your Honor, in one very important way, everybody involved in this case, I think, is on the same side. We all want to combat the opioid epidemic. Where we differ is on the methods for doing so. Most importantly, for purposes of today's hearing, as Your Honor already indicated, are the legal issues. And we believe that injection sites are forbidden under federal law. And I think you summed it up perfectly, both in the prior hearing and in your comments before I came to the podium, about it's your job here to apply a statute to the facts. The statute at issue is 21 United States Code, Section 856A.
I've actually had that made available in the Elmo, Mr. McSwain.
Terrific.
Ms. Hawk, would you bring that up, please?
With your indulgence, Your Honor, when you bring it up, may I go through the words just quickly?
For purposes of the record, yes, but then I'd like to get to some of my questions, actually.
Sure. So 21 United States Code, Section 856A, now on the screen, makes it a crime to either, number one, knowingly open, lease, rent, use, or maintain any place, whether permanently or temporarily, for the purpose of manufacturing, distributing, or using any controlled substance, or number two, manage or control any place, whether permanently or temporarily, either as an owner, lessee, agent, employee, occupant, or mortgagee, and knowingly and intentionally rent, lease, profit from, or make available for use, with or without compensation, the place for the purpose of unlawfully manufacturing, storing, distributing, or using a controlled substance. Your Honor, I think the statute is clear that Congress has made a judgment. And I think I can sum that judgment up very simply as, don't set up a place to do drugs.
Let me ask you this, Mr. McSwain. The statute in question was passed in 1986 and amended in 2003. Is it the position of the government that safe injection sites were in any respect within the contemplation of Congress at either stage?
Absolutely, yes. Not just injection sites, but any so-called medical use of heroin and other illegal substances. That's because the statute expressly says there is no medical use for heroin, there can be no prescriptions for heroin, nobody, anywhere, anyhow, is allowed to use heroin under the law. So if I, for example, had a time machine, and I went back to the time that Congress passed the statute, and I said, hey, Congress, listen up, I got an idea. My idea is I'm going to invite people onto my property, and I'm going to invite them to use heroin as much as they want, anytime they want, but I'm going to have medical personnel on site available to combat any overdoses. The answer from Congress to that hypothetical would have been no way.
Well, you're channeling Judge Posner now, who basically would say in a situation like this, we would go back in time and we would conjure what it is that Congress might have had in its mind. And he's written about that. And let's say hypothetically, I don't think there's broad support for that in the case law, and say hypothetically, I don't think analytically that's the best way to go. And I understand the argument you're constructing here, that because in the Controlled Substances Act, there was no lawful use of narcotics that was contemplated, that it necessarily follows by inference or by logical conclusion that Congress also meant to address this activity. Fair enough. My question was different and more precise. And that precise question is, if we look at what we'll call the legislative evidence surrounding the passage of the statute in 1986 or its amendment in 2003, can you point to any legislative evidence that would suggest that there was specific contemplation of things such as safe injection sites, keeping in mind your argument about the broad language?
Well, I would say, first off, the best legislative evidence is always the words of the statute.
Understood.
So if we look at the words of the statute, for example, well, let me describe my view of the statute broadly, and then I will specifically answer your question.
Yeah, I am going to look for a specific answer to the question.
Well, we have A1 and we have A2. And I think that what A1 and A2 are doing in conjunction is they're taking that judgment that Congress has made that said, don't set up a drug house. And A1 is saying, don't do it directly. And A2 is saying, don't do it indirectly. And to answer your question directly, I think your concern is most directly addressed by A2. Because look at the language of A2. For example, it says, with or without compensation. So it's not a case where Congress is saying that there has to be some money-making drug operation in order for 856A to apply. A1 says, don't do it directly. Don't open up the house for the purpose of having people, or for the purpose of dealing, manufacturing, using drugs. And under A2, don't do it.
We could draw numerous inferences as to how the language could be interpreted. And we could even say that one literally reading the words of the statute could say it would apply in this situation. So let's assume that's true.
Okay.
Let's also assume that that may not be enough for a variety of reasons. Going back to my question, and that is specifically with respect to the concept of safe injection sites. Is there any legislative evidence that that was within the contemplation of Congress?
I don't mean to avoid your question, Your Honor, but again, I would say the best legislative evidence is the actual words of the statute. And
okay.
It's not just the words of A2.
Other than the words in the statute.
Well, other than the words in A2, there's also the other words talking about how specifically there's no medical exemption for heroin. So I think it does directly address your question. Congress was contemplating all types of situations where heroin might be used in a so-called medical way, like in treatment centers, in hospitals, whatever. And they said no. And what that really...
Well, with respect to some drugs, not heroin, but with others, there were specific provisions that were made for physicians to use them either by way of prescription in clinical trials or for research purposes, and that was clearly within the contemplation of Congress, and I'll concede all that. So I take it that the answer to my question is no, you cannot point to anything in the legislative evidence that would show that safe injection sites were specifically within the contemplation of Congress. And if I'm wrong about that, then point to where that would be. Because I'll be candid with you, I haven't been able to find it. But I'll also be candid with you, I'm not surprised I was unable to find it, because with respect to the idea of harm reduction, before we even get to safe injection sites, it was an evolving medical discipline, and it's highly unlikely that it would have been within the canon of Congress in 1986 or 2003. And we can talk about the ways that's tested later, but is there anything specifically you can point to, sir? And the legislative evidence.
If you're looking specifically for legislative history,
I'm using the word evidence deliberately because I'm trying to keep in mind that the term legislative history is sometimes loaded and misused. And as we've been analyzing the problem, we've tried to show a lot of discipline in how we approach it and looking at how scholars are approaching what is or is not properly considered, if anything, recognizing that if the government's correct and the language is absolutely clear, we may not get to that, and recognizing that Justice Scalia would say, I think his word is garbage, one never considers it, I think that there's ample precedent and recently an en banc decision from the Third Circuit in Pellegrino that says in certain instances, yes, it is appropriate. So whether we call it legislative history or legislative evidence, can you point to anything there?
First of all, I'm going to put aside my statutory arguments because you want me to put them aside, and I agree with your mentioning of Justice Scalia where he thinks of legislative history as like coming into a crowded party and looking across the room to pick out your friends, as I think is the way he described it. It's very malleable, and so it's much more important to look at the actual words of the statute. But there are some statements by Senator Biden. There are some statements at the time of the amendments of 856 that don't specifically talk about injection sites, but the language and the logic of the statements would apply to injection sites. For example, in the 2003 amendment, Senator Biden said the bill targets any venue whose purpose is to engage in legal narcotics activity. That's very broad. He talks about my bill would help in the prosecution of rogue promoters who not only know that there is drug use at their event, but also hold the event for the purpose of the illegal drug use. It doesn't mean that they're selling drugs.
He also says it's addressed to predatory behavior elsewhere in his statements about that. He also says that it was meant to have a limited scope, which is in part why they addressed the language in the way that they did, and then two, not only talked about knowingly, but knowingly and intentionally. So suffice to say there are many nuggets both ways. And for the benefit of both parties in their briefs have cited statements by Senator Biden after the enactment of the statute. And again, looking at some of the scholarship on legislative history and indeed some case law, we're loath to put much weight on post-enactment statements. And so both parties cited those in their briefing. And in terms of how we have tried to exercise discipline in looking anything beyond the words of the statute, we've applied that standard. So I think it's useful for the parties to know that.
We didn't do a lot of that in our brief, Your Honor. There are a couple more statements I'd like to point out that may be helpful to you.
Not right at the moment, because okay. I think for those purposes, we've done a pretty deep dive into the legislative record, and we've tried to parse very carefully what was said when and in what context. Because, again, some of the things that legal scholars have said in looking at legislative evidence is it needs to come with an appreciation of the congressional process and the congressional rules. So, indeed, it matters greatly at what point in time something is being debated, something is being said, and something is being amended. So we're going to be applying that discipline and looking at it. But I understand, I think, the position you're taking, that there's a great deal there that could, in an intellectually honest way, be taken both in the words of the statute and in the discussion and applied to Safe House. That would essentially be your argument.
I would agree with that, but I would say that there's an express prohibition that Congress has reached this exact issue when they said no medical use. And there is one case that came pretty darn close to analyzing a situation just like that. I'm sure you're familiar with it, but the Thibault case in the Eighth Circuit.
We're talking the rock concert.
Yes, SafeStock, where they had a musical festival, and one of the defendants' arguments was We have a medical facility. That's what they called it. That's what the court described it in the opinion. The Eighth Circuit said there's a medical facility at this music festival, and the purpose of the medical facility was to reverse overdoses. And the court found liability under A2 there.
They found liability on that basis. I think the case had a lot of weight because, indeed, when we looked at it, we said, well, that's an interesting, perhaps, parallel here. But when you looked at the other overwhelming evidence of encouraging illegal drug use, in fact, the concert promoter there actually had different schedules of drugs. You can't use these, but you can use those. And that was all part of the jury's deliberation and the evidence in the case, with the first aid stand being there, but I don't think central to the evidence that resulted in conviction.
It's so not on all fours of the situation. I agree with you. But it was interesting that at least that argument has been floated before. It's not, you're not writing on a complete tabula rasa. You have at least that case that has looked at this issue that's very close to our issue.
Well, that's why we studied the facts so closely, to see how much weight we think it carried. And I thought that was a creative argument by the defense, given the overwhelming evidence against the concert promoter, who also was making a profit. But I'm not sure that it really carries great weight in a situation like this.
I would agree that there's not any case that's directly like this case. But there is language, lots of language in the statute that directly applies to this. And also, I think the Oakland Cannabis Buyers case, the Supreme Court case that we've talked about some already in court, is very applicable. There, they were talking about marijuana as a Schedule 1 drug, just like heroin. Not talking about Schedule 2, like in the Oregon case, which is different, where you can write prescriptions for Schedule 2. Schedule 1, can't write prescriptions for it, have no medical use for it, but there's one express exception available only for government-approved research projects. But that is not a project that was being pursued in that case. It's not a project that's being pursued here. So there are no exceptions. So Congress has directly already reached this issue and said no. And what the Oakland Cannabis Buyers case, I think, really stands for, if you boil it down to sort of the layman's language, when Congress says no, no means no. That's
except
what that case says.
Safe House is not handing out any illegal drugs, correct?
They're not handing out drugs, but under A2 and under the statute 56, that doesn't matter. All that matters is you're making your place available for use. And
yeah, no, we're going to get into A2 in a moment, because I'd like to move there next. But I will say this about both that case and Gonzalez versus Oregon that Safe House is citing. I don't think either of them shed great light on the issue before the court. I think they're part of the gestalt of the case, and they give us a perspective on how it is that the Controlled Substances Act takes into account the fact that these substances are used in different ways, and in the background of the problem of drug use, legal and illegal, there's a medical context. But aside from that, I'm not sure that they directly inform the issue before the court. I'd like to talk a little bit about A2 and the difference between A2 and A1, because the government does cite an impressive battery of circuit decisions in its brief, and obviously we've looked at them very closely. And in all candor, when I look at those cases, all of them seem to follow the Fifth Circuit's decision in Chen. And they follow the Fifth Circuit's decision in Chen on the point as to whose purpose it has to be in A2. They do it without any real analysis of what the circuit did in Chen. And I don't say that in a critical way, because I don't think in any instance the record before those circuits required them to get into a deep analysis of whether Chen was correct in the distinctions that it drew. But one of the things that I am concerned about is that Chen says that if we look at A1 and we look at A2, according to the Fifth Circuit, A2 would be redundant. And the only way to make it non-redundant is to apply the rule against surplusage and to assume that in A2 the purpose has to be the purpose of the actual user of the drugs rather than the possessor of the facility. And I'm going to probably use the word possessor here just because we've got owners and renters and all manner of others. And what troubles me about that, Mr. McSwain, is that I think you can easily read 1 and 2 not to be redundant, because I think you read 1 to say that's where the possessor themselves are engaging in the activity, or is engaging in the activity, and A2 is where others are, but their purpose is to have those others engage in it. So I didn't share the Fifth Circuit's bafflement as to what the difference between 1 and 2 is. Why can't 1 and 2 be read the way I've suggested? One is the possessor themselves is engaging in the activity.
When you talk about the possessor, do you mean the possessor of the place or the drugs?
The place.
The place, okay.
So possessor of land. I mean, and I'm
got
using
it.
Possessor because we've got owners, we've got lessors,
understood.
We've got operators, we've got squatters, we've got all kinds of folks. So I'm using possessor. And I think logically 1 is written to say the possessor themselves is using the property for that purpose. And B, the possessor is, for the purpose of allowing others to do it, engaging in that conduct. And I think that the purpose requirement would apply equally to the possessor in both 1 and 2. Chen disagrees. Chen says, no, when you get to 2, you don't look at the possessor's purpose. You look at the user's purpose. And I'm having trouble with that proposition because I'm not baffled in the way that Chen was baffled.
I think the way Chen, well, first of all, I don't think that Chen is the only case that really analyzes the issue. Some of the other cases, Thibault, for example, and other circuits, they're not just saying we follow Chen blindly. They're looking at the same statute, and I think there is some meaningful discussion there. But to answer your question,
I didn't find it, just to be candid with you, because we look for it.
A1 and A2 can't talk about the same purpose or the possessor's purpose in the same way, because if they did that, the statute would be nonsensical and self-defeating. And what I mean by that is you could be a stone-cold crack dealer and you could say that my purpose is to make money. My purpose is not for drugs to be used. And therefore, if you look at A1 or A2, I get off scot-free. There would be a self-defeating statute. That doesn't make any sense. You have to look at A1 and A2 and, first of all, assume that Congress is not simply being redundant. They're not going to have an A1 and A2.
I don't think they were redundant, and I don't think A1 and A2 are redundant. And I think if somebody argued as a defendant what you just argued, the court would say that has no merit because we're looking about the use to which the property is being put, either by you as possessor and you doing something there, or you as possessor intending for somebody else to do something there. So I think we fundamentally disagree about whether or not they're redundant.
We may be talking past each other. And in A2, I think the key is that the possessor is making available for use to others, and it's their purpose, the other's purpose, that matters, which is the way that Chen interpreted, which I thought, and you're disagreeing with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I think if you disagree with that, well, then you are running headlong into the absurd situation where a crack dealer could say, I get off scot-free because my purpose is the only one that matters, and my purpose is to make money.
I think that's wordplay, and I think a court would say that it's wordplay and say to that defendant, no, we're talking about your use of the property. Either you've got this property and you're using it for this purpose, or you've got this property and with the intent to allow others to use it for this purpose or allowing them to do so. That's what I think a court would say, and that's what I would say.
Well, going down that path, I would say that if you look at the facts in this case, it is a necessary precondition to Safehouse's stated purpose. I mean, they want to unilaterally say that our stated purpose is to save lives or to prevent overdoses, however you want, there's some medical reason. But a necessary precondition of that is the use of drugs. That means that 856 covers it. If you want to talk about wordplay or semantic play, that's wordplay and semantic play.
Well, we're going to get to purpose and how purpose can operate on many levels, I think, as we get deeper into the discussion. But I'd like just to stay on Chen for a moment, okay, to show you the degree to which we've tried to look at this, all right? So when Chen says, gee, these must be redundant and we're going to read the statute in a different way, they apply a canon, right, the rule against surplusage. And as Professor Llewellyn said in a famous article years ago, one of the problems with canons, which are now in vogue but not so much back in the day, is for every canon there's a counter canon. And so the canon against surplusage is offset by the canon of consistent usage. And that is, if a word is presumed to have the same meaning throughout the text. So here we are, and we've got within the very same subsection of a statute, use of the word for the purpose of. And the Chen court says, well, in 1 it means one thing, and in 2 it means another thing. So in applying the rule against surplusage, they're violating the rule against consistent usage. And isn't that a problem for a court in looking at what, you know, I think, in Tableau, they talked about the logic of Chen, and I'll be honest with you, I'm grappling with the logic of Chen and not quite seeing it. What would your response be to the violation of the rule in favor of consistent usage?
My response would be to frame it slightly differently. Purpose in both 1 and 2 has the same meaning in terms of purpose, meaning, object, goal, whatever synonym you want to use. But the key is whose purpose.
Oh,
so, you have to look,
yeah.
So you have to look at the context of the whole statute and all the words in 1 and 2 and the broader statutory scheme to come up with the logical conclusion. Really, I think the only logical conclusion is that whose purpose in A2 is the user's purpose and whose purpose in A1 is the possessor's purpose.
So Congress, without explicitly drawing that distinction, uses purpose, you know, one after the other in the same statute. And just leaves it to the reader of statute to then infer that in two it's the purpose of the user? I mean, that's what you're really asking me to conclude.
Well, I'm asking you to conclude that on all of the words in 1 and 2. So here are some of the key differences between 1 and 2, if I could enumerate them.
Well, there's only one I'm interested in, okay? In two, we have, in one, we have knowingly and for the purpose of. In two, we have knowingly and intentionally for the purpose of. So, would you agree with me that if you add intentionally in two, that's a somewhat perhaps higher standard that would need to be met for purposes of criminality?
I think that the positioning of knowingly and intentionally in two is different, for example, of the positioning of knowing in one. So let me describe for a moment what the differences are between 1 and 2 textually, because I think they really are important, and it's important to look at all of them.
I'll give you the leeway to do that, but...
Okay. See if I can convince you.
That's what you're here to do.
In A1, it says knowingly open. That, again, is consistent with the idea of directly opening a drug house. Knowingly open. Whereas the beginning of A2, it talks about manage or control. It's more indirect. You're not knowingly opening a drug house. You're just managing or controlling a place. And then also you have in A2, very important that you don't have in A1, make available for use. That sort of changes the whole tenor of 2 compared to 1. 1, again, is direct. Don't you open yourself, knowingly open directly a drug house. Number 2 is talking about making available for use. We're making available for who? Making available for others. Making available for the people that Chen was talking about and every other circuit court that has looked at this, all 5 courts. So you also have with or without compensation. I think that's consistent because you don't have with or without compensation in A1.
That's because A2 is addressing a wider variety facility, right?
Correct.
Yes.
But that's
the
also
rave, the rock concert, etc.
Correct. But that's also consistent with the idea of making available for use to others. Because in a lot of those situations where you're making available for use for others, you're not making money yourself. You're not in it for the profit. You just happen to know, you have the knowledge that there's drug use at your location. And that's why Chen and other courts have said you can't have a willful blindness instruction in A1, but you can have one in A2. Because in A1, it's direct.
No, I agree with that. And candidly, I think the courts tied themselves up in knots to a certain degree because you could still have a willful indifference kind of a standard instruction even if the purpose in A2 refers to the possessor of the land. But let me ask you this. Did Chen say anything about intentionally in its discussion? I mean, did they even mention the fact that intentionally also appears in A2? Because, again, I didn't see it.
I don't think they discussed that, but I think the fact that knowingly intentionally is in the middle of A2 and not in the beginning of A2 matters. They're talking about knowingly and intentionally renting, leasing, profiting from, or making available for use the place for the purpose. That's consistent with intentionally making available for others. Not for yourself, not to set up the drug house yourself, because A1 and A2 are different. We have to assume that Congress didn't just make a mistake and have it overlap.
I actually think Chen may shed a little light on the argument you're making now, and I'd go to footnote 9, okay? And this is what Chen says. Our research reveals at least 16 federal criminal statutes that use the combination of knowingly and for the purpose of. A review of those shows that the purpose requirement clearly goes to the actor in the statute, the one who has the knowledge, right? And so if, based on that review of 16 criminal statutes, they said that that requirement would go to the actor, which in this case is the possessor, and it would go to them as of A1, why not 2 as well? I mean, why doesn't the same analysis apply there, that it carries all the way through to the actor? If in 16 federal criminal statutes where those terms are combined, that's the individual to whom it refers.
I haven't looked at all 16 of those cases that are cited in footnote 9. But
that's statutes, actually.
Those statutes. But if we were to go look at those statutes, again, we'd have to look at the whole statute. We have to look at all the words in the statute, and that would inform whether purpose is referring to one person or another. Here, we have to do the same thing. When you look at A2 and you see the additional words, or make available for use, we see the additional words, with or without compensation. We know there's already an A1. The logical conclusion is that A2 is referring to others' purpose.
But doesn't it say knowingly, and then right after knowingly comes unintentionally? I mean, it follows right after knowingly in 2, does it not?
Yes, you can knowingly, intentionally make available for use somebody else doing something for their purpose. There's no inconsistency there. There's no barrier you're running into just because they use the words knowingly, intentionally, the A2, it has to refer to the possessor's purpose. It can refer to the user's purpose because it's talking about right after those words, or make available for use, implying that it's make available for use to others. Otherwise, why would those words be in there?
Well, I'm supposed to give meaning to every word, correct? And so I'm supposed to give meaning to the word intentionally. And so you would agree with me that I have to grapple with in A2, Congress has added, in addition to knowingly and for the purpose of, knowingly and intentionally for the purpose of.
I agree. Every word the statute should have meaning, but here it's easy because Safe House knowingly and intentionally is making available for use the people who are going to bring heroin onto the property and use it. There's no hard factual issue.
We're going to get the purpose in a moment, and I think I'll get off with Chen and his progeny and everything else. But before I do, I just wanted to touch on one of the other cases the government cited, and it was the Third Circuit case that they cited. It's a non-precedential case, but it is a case that you cited. And it was written by Judge Schwartz, joined by Chief Judge Smith, and joined by former Chief Judge Sirica. And so, do you have that handy?
I don't have it in front of me, but I'm familiar with the case, if you want to ask me a question about it.
I want to look at how the Third Circuit, when they were addressing the statute, couched it. Because even though it's a non-precedential case, I guess it's persuasive authority like a circuit court decision that's not within the Third Circuit. And there you had a conviction under A2 for use of an apartment for purposes of drug dealing. And the court reviewed the evidence and they upheld the conviction. And in doing so, they said, accordingly, the jury was entitled to infer Balkman, he was the defendant, intended that the property be used for manufacturing and storing controlled substances. Now, again, Mr. McSwain, this is under A2. And in that case, the Third Circuit looked to the possessor's intent and the possessor's purpose in deciding whether or not the conviction could be sustained. So what am I to make of that as persuasive authority in terms of my concerns with Chen? Hasn't the Third Circuit looked at the statute through the same eyes that I'm looking at it?
We cited that case for the general proposition that a statute or a conviction under 856 was upheld, but it's non-precedential for a reason, honestly, Your Honor. It's not something I think you should rely on. When the Third Circuit issues non-precedential opinions, it's for a reason. It's because they don't go through the same kind of vetting, the same kind of analysis, often much longer opinions, opinions that are then circulated to the whole court before they're issued, where they would have looked much closer at A1 and A2, and I think that language that you're citing is a little bit loose. I don't think that it's accurate. I think that A1 and A2 are different, and it was a matter of them upholding the conviction in a short non-precedential opinion. And the Third Circuit is also very strict about not relying on non-precedential opinions if we're ever in a Third Circuit arguing this case.
I rarely cite them, and I raise it in part because the government did. But it struck me as interesting that at least on their review of it, they seem to have the same general take that I did. So we'll see what all that means later. Let's sort of, if we can, transition, because you've been there already, to the issue of purpose, okay? And Safe House, I mean, you say this the meeting's plain here, and this is illegal. And Safe House says no, and I'll call this an ordinary meaning argument rather than a plain text argument or a plain meaning, because that's fraught with peril as well. And in support of that, on the definition of purpose, Safe House cites the various dictionaries. And I'll begin with the observation. I'm not a huge fan of citing the dictionaries, but the Supreme Court does so, did so in Yates. And last week, the Court of Appeals en banc did so, and said we begin there. So Safehouse says, if you look at Black's Law Dictionary, purpose is an objective, a goal, or an end. And then they cite Merriam-Webster. And they say purpose is something set up as an object or end to be attained. So let me just ask you, in your view, what is the objective, goal, or end that Safehouse is pursuing with this proposed project?
Well, there are a number of objectives or goals. I don't quarrel with the dictionary definition of purpose. I would say that there's the threshold question of whose purpose matters, but we've already kind of talked about that between A1 and A2. But certainly cases, there are plenty of cases out there that say that as long as a purpose, meaning a purpose, that's enough in A1. You don't get to unilaterally just say that I have one purpose and I hereby declare what my purpose is.
Just
like
silly.
If you're the crack dealer and you say that my purpose is just to make money, well, that's not really going to be good enough. Again, but I think the reason for that is because you have to look at what is a necessary precondition to all the other purposes you might talk about. So if you're the crack dealer and you say, I'm just going to make money, well, it's a necessary precondition that there's illegal drug use on your property and you're inviting people to do it. And if you're Safehouse, if you say your purpose is to save lives, that's a laudable purpose, but it's a necessary precondition that you're inviting people onto your property to break the law. And so therefore, that purpose, I think, would violate A1.
Isn't Safehouse going to get up and say, well, before anybody injects on our premises, we first assess them and we've given them an offer of service, and our goal would be to prevent them or dissuade them from using drugs, and we proceed to injection only when that initial purpose has failed. And coincidentally, if they do inject, it remains our purpose to dissuade them from using drugs and then in an emergency save their life so that ultimately we hope to dissuade them from using drugs.
They've never said that. It would surprise me if they were to say that. That's directly contrary to what Mr. Benitez said. I know we're not going to get into the testimony, and you made that clear. But for us to say that Safehouse's purpose is to stop people from using drugs, and when people come in, they're going to give them a speech about don't use drugs.
Well, it's not a speech, but they are assessing them and offering them services, and the services would include medically assisted treatment, correct?
I think that it would be engaging in make-believe for us to say that the purpose of Safehouse is to stop people from using drugs. The purpose of Safehouse is their medical, they profess it to be their medical purpose, but I think that it's clear that a necessary precondition is the use of drugs, and certainly the purpose of the people coming to the facility would be to use drugs. Again, I don't want to belabor Mr. Benitez's testimony, but
Dumb.
Was talking about, Safehouse in general. I won't talk about Mr. Benitez, but Safehouse in general.
We can proceed to discovery and trial, but I mean, I don't think that's what we were here to do.
Well, I would just say that there's no support in the record for the hypothetical that you're describing.
All right, so when they say assessment of physical and behavioral health offer of services, what do you take that to mean?
Can you repeat that, please, Your Honor?
Well, I'm looking at Exhibit 1 to the government's complaint. And after registration, it says assessment of physical and behavioral health offer of services. And that's in advance of anybody entering a consumption room.
I don't think any of those services are designed to stop people from using the consumption room. I think that the reason that they're there and the reason the Safehouse exists is so that people can come and use the consumption room. So again, I think this is going down a path that's just anti-factual.
Okay, and that may be defined by the scope of the pleadings. And maybe we read the pleadings differently, but we'll wait and see what Safehouse has to say. Let's say I certainly agree with you that there's no merit to an argument that the sole purpose would have to be unlawful, that an unlawful purpose would suffice. Is there any limiting principle to the statute that you see?
Well, there is a limiting principle, I think, and the courts that have discussed the idea of a purpose or a purpose being enough under A1 have talked about how it can't be just an incidental purpose.
Right.
It can't be just sort of something very minor. And Safehouse cites in their briefs, and I want to get into some of these hypos about, say, a child is a drug addict and they come home and they're using drugs in their parents' home, and could that possibly be actionable under 856? That would only be an incidental purpose. And
yeah,
presumably,
I agree with you. Let me give you a different hypo that's similar but related. And that is, it's an adult child, so it's not in loco parentis. They are using, parents said don't use, and finally said move in. We don't want you to use, but if you're going to use, we want to use right here in our presence, and we've got Narcan here. So shoot up, but do it while we're here, and do it while we can resuscitate you. Would that be reached by A2?
I think it wouldn't, because of the words you said about don't use. That's not their purpose for their son, their adult son or adult daughter, to be in the home, is to use drugs. They're trying to stop that person from using drugs. And let me take your hypo one step further, since we're in this gray area, where if those parents knew that their son or daughter had a major drug problem and knew that their friends had major drug problems and their friends liked to come over to the house and use drugs, and then they said to their son or daughter, hey, you know what, I'm going to the Bahamas for a month. You know where all the food is. You know the phone book.
You're taking my hypos for safe house.
Well, I'm saying, I'll see you later. I'll see you in a month. And if during that month, that house turned into Party Central, that could be a violation of 856.
Okay.
That could be a violation under A2. Okay, so now these hypos, I think, are very useful, but the initial hypo that you asked about would not be a violation of 856 because it's only incidental and the parents are trying to stop the drug use.
But let me ask you this very precise question. Is it the government's position that Safe House is trying to promote the use of illegal narcotics?
Is the government's position that is a necessary precondition to everything that they want to do that illegal drugs are going to be used, and that is prohibited by Congress expressly?
I understand the government's position, but what's your answer to my question?
Whether they're trying to promote it or not?
Right.
I think that it is inevitable that they are, in fact, promoting it. And again, they haven't alleged, I don't believe, and without focusing on the testimony, although Mr. Benitez did talk about this, they haven't said that it's going to be more successful getting people into treatment than what we already have in Prevention Point. So the purpose of Safe House is not to get people into treatment because Prevention Point is already doing that. And the testimony is consistent that it's not going to be any more successful at Safe House than it already is at Prevention Point. So, therefore, the logical implication of setting up Safe House is that there's going to be more drug use. So, yes, they are promoting drug use.
Okay, but is there going to be more drug use than is occurring outside the door or over at MacArthur Park?
I think you could argue either way. Certainly we would argue that there would be. We believe that there would be. But again, you have to come back to the statute. I mean, we've wandered pretty far away from 856.
I'm testing the limits of 856.
If there's more drug use on the property, which is what 856 cares about, then it's a criminal violation. What happens in the rest of the neighborhood, what happens in the rest of the city, may be theoretically interesting, but it's ultimately irrelevant to the question before you.
If the question before me is purpose, I'm not sure it is irrelevant. Let me try a different hypothetical. We know that already Prevention Point is doing needle exchange. We know that they routinely respond to overdoses. Say Safe House says, we're going to buy a lunch truck, and we're going to retrofit it, and we're going to have our oxygen and defibrillator and our Narcan there, and we're going to pull up to the park where people shoot up every day and open the window. And we're going to just assume people will come and shoot up there in front of our emergency vehicle. Literally, the statute doesn't apply to that, correct?
I think that's correct because they're not knowingly opening a place and they're not managing or control any place. So I think the statutory language doesn't reach it. And again, that's what matters, the statutory language.
They're doing everything but in a mobile unit.
Well, if they were to have people come into the mobile unit, that's different. But if they were just to pull up next to a public park, no, I don't think 856 would reach that. And those distinctions matter.
All right. Earlier we talked about the medical background of the Controlled Substances Act, right? And I said I think it's in the background of the case because I don't know that the exemption and the authorization provisions directly apply, though maybe we'll touch on that in a moment. But if you look at the 2003
refinement of the statute. Certainly, what was on the minds of Congress at that point did not involve any type of provision of medical services. Would you agree with that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your Honor? I apologize.
We're talking about raves, we're talking about concert venues, we're talking about other venues where people will go for purposes of use of illegal drugs. That's what was within the if we look at the debate that consumed Congress at that time, those were the subjects on which they focused, correct?
Yes, but I don't think you can ignore the rest of the Controlled Substances Act, which I think directly addresses the idea of medical use of heroin, which is prohibited.
Right, but Safe House, let's say I'm not enamored of their argument that this is an authorized use, but they do point out that Congress was careful to say that there are certain activities on the part of medical providers that will not be reached by the Controlled Substances Act. And if we're in a situation where explicitly this type of situation is not addressed, is that background relevant when Congress says in some instances we take into account whether it's predatory conduct or whether there is some other purpose being served? What's your reaction to that?
My reaction is that Congress has expressly ruled on this. It's 21 United States Code 812B1B, and they have rejected that heroin is safe for use even under medical supervision. Again, what that stands for, and then interpreting a very similar situation in the Oakland cannabis case, when Congress says no, no means no. And they've explicitly already addressed this issue, even though it's a broader issue than just a debate about injection sites themselves. So the broader includes the lesser.
I understand your position, Mr. McSwain. Getting back to this issue of whether or not Safe House could seek an exemption for the conduct that it wants to pursue, and I'm not sure how much weight this has or that it really has any bearing. But return to the question that I sort of threw out earlier, which is, within the statute, at least, I didn't detect any mechanism that would allow for them to apply for permission to conduct an activity such as this. Can you steer me to any that exist?
I don't think there is one that really exists. This is not a research project, for example. But the fact that there isn't one also highlights that they haven't even tried. They haven't tried anything in the state legislature. They really haven't tried anything in city council either. They certainly haven't tried in Congress. And one of our main arguments, as you well know, is that they're on the steps of the wrong institution. They're on the steps of the courthouse. They should be on the steps of the legislature. They should be asking Congress to change the law, and there should be a public debate about that. And we welcome that. Okay, like I said in the beginning, we're all on the same side here. And Congress, in the CARA Act in 2016, the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act, and the Support Act after that, is laser focused on the opioid epidemic, and they have never approved of injection sites. So this debate needs to happen in Congress. The public policy debate does not belong in the courthouse when it comes to this statute.
Yeah, I think what Safe House would say is, well, we're in the courthouse because A, of the threat of prosecution, and then B, the government decided, well, we're not going to prosecute, we'll do this through a declaratory judgment action. And that it's the government that should go to Congress, because if it's not illegal, then we ought to be able to do it. And so, and I, you're going to disagree with that, but let me put that in the broader context that you're raising, which is what's the appropriate venue to decide these issues. Mm-hmm. Because there's no doubt that Congress writes statutes that sometimes the courts are left to apply and interpret. But as I read the law, that happens in the civil arena. So it happens with civil RICO, and it happens with Title VII. But I don't see that it happens in the field of criminal law, where, generally speaking, courts are urged and in many instances do in fact exercise restraint, saying that when it comes to the criminalization of activities, that is uniquely the decision of the legislature. And this sort of, I guess, backs us into the rule of lenity discussion, right? Which I know you say doesn't apply, and I think on one level it doesn't apply. But isn't there an institutional separation of powers theme to the case law on the rule of lenity? And hasn't the Supreme Court itself repeatedly said that when it comes to criminalization, if it's not clear, that's the role of Congress? What would your reaction be to that?
First of all, if you're suggesting that there's no such thing as federal criminal common law. I agree with you. It's sort of one of the starting points, and it's all supposed to be statutory.
Right.
So, yes, we have to look at the statute.
Right.
But here, the statute, I think, is clear, and certainly, as Your Honor recognized during the last hearing, it's sort of self-evident that the people who are coming onto the property would be violating the law.
They are.
Violating,
absolutely.
Right. So if the people coming onto the property have the purpose of breaking the law, and they are breaking the law, and the person that's setting up the property so that the law can be broken are themselves liable. That's very clear. And the rule of lenity only applies when courts look at a criminal statute and they literally throw their hands up in the air and say, I can't figure this out for the life of me. This doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, there's grievous ambiguity, as I believe the Supreme Court has described it, so we're going to apply the rule of lenity. That's not the case here at all. And that's why, for example, five circuits have looked at this and none of them have found any grievous ambiguity or any ambiguity at all.
Well, no one's looked at a safe injection site.
No one's looked specifically at these facts, although, again, you have SafeStock, which we already talked about, but they have looked at the statute, and the way they've interpreted the statute would clearly cover what we're talking about here. Again, because there's no question that the people coming onto the property are there to break the law. Now, if there were a gray area there, I'd have a much harder argument. Okay, that would be a totally different situation. Here we've got a slam dunk situation where every single person who's there is invited to come onto that property to break the law. Can't be allowed.
Okay, but again, if you want to look at the overall structure of the statute, right? That person coming onto the site to use will face a year, or depending upon their record, 3 years for use. And a nonprofit medical entity with a harm reduction strategy seeking to save their life would face a 20-year penalty. Now, I'm not suggesting that Congress did that, but I am suggesting that it seems improbable to me that Congress would be doing that, and I am suggesting to you that that lends further weight to the suggestion that perhaps this was not within the contemplation of Congress, and that recognizing these divisions of power, should a federal court be careful in extending that degree of criminality to this conduct? That's the question I'm raising.
Well, even SafeHouse itself and Mr. Benitez said that they hadn't done this before because they thought they'd lose their building, or they basically knew it was illegal. So what has changed over 11 years that he's been working at Prevention Point? What's changed is that SafeHouse has just gotten to the point where they said, we know better. We're going to do this.
Or it's the death toll.
Well, the opioid epidemic has been going on for years. And also, we are making a lot of progress. I know we don't want to get into the facts.
And that's the only comment I've made that's gotten beyond this round, but I felt compelled to make it.
But I think that the way we brought this case, Your Honor, also points to the fact that this shouldn't happen. We shouldn't have the kind of criminal confrontation that you're contemplating. It's not going to be isn't going to be a situation, I presume, where somebody faces that sort of liability if the court, we think properly, says this isn't allowed. And there's a civil case where you can say it isn't allowed.
And I previously commended you for proceeding in that way.
Well, thank you. I really, we're all on the same side here in trying to deal with the opioid epidemic. But, Your Honor, I think the hubris here is pretty astonishing from SafeHouse.
Well,
they literally
are to the point
where they're saying, we know better, we're going to do it anyway. So we had no choice but to bring this case, and we brought a civil case to give you an opportunity to rule. Now, I don't think that we are the bad guy for doing that.
I'm not calling you the bad guy, and I've commended you for proceeding in this way. I have a hard time attacking the motives of folks on the front lines of what you say.
Well, thank you.
So that exhausts my questions, unless there's any other burning point you would like to make.
No, Your Honor, but could I reserve a couple minutes to respond?
I'm not going to cut anybody off here. I think you've already seen that with this court.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We're not on that tight of a time schedule. And why don't we just take a 5-minute break, and then we'll resume. Thank you.
All right.
The whole Shepherd pad of questions for you, Ms. Isaacson.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. If I may make an introductory statement, and I think some of this goes without saying, but SafeHouse has a singular purpose, which is to save the lives of our loved ones who are suffering from opioid addiction, and our community, which, as this court is well aware, is ravaged by this overdose crisis. And we're accomplishing that mission by keeping people who are at risk of overdose in close proximity to medical care. We strongly dispute the idea that drug use is a necessary precondition to fulfilling our purpose. We want nothing more, and the purpose of Safe House is directed entirely at people ceasing the use of drugs and hopefully entering into treatment. There would be nothing better than for Safe House to not be needed. Unfortunately, the time that we have between the time that a person consumes and the time that they need rescue from naloxone or respiratory support and emergency care is preciously slim. And the directive of Safe House is to close that gap, that very small gap in time that can be the difference between life and death. Federal law, in our view, does not require we cast people out of the reach of medical care at the time when they're most vulnerable, which is the time of consumption and the immediate time thereafter. And that is the necessary consequence of the government's position here. We believe that if Congress were to intend that, it would have said so explicitly, and that this statute, which, as Your Honor pointed out in the questioning before, was in no way directed at supervised consumption or the overdose crisis that we presently face, in no way explicitly addresses that or even implies that it was getting at the kind of public health and medical intervention that Safe House intends to create here in Philadelphia.
All right, let's get to the statute.
Let's do it.
Right under A, it says, except as authorized by this subchapter. And I really don't follow your argument that unless this activity is specifically prohibited, it's authorized. Might be one thing to say, well, unless it's specifically prohibited, it's not criminal. But I really don't see how you get to authorize.
Your Honor, I think it derives, I know you said you weren't too convinced by Oregon versus Gonzalez, but if you'll bear with me in the part of Oregon versus Gonzalez where it talks about the general approach of the Controlled Substances Act to medical practice, it references back to one of the seminal cases dealing with the Controlled Substances Act, which was Moore. And Moore was a case that dealt exactly with this except as authorized by language in Title 21 U.S.C. 841.
I'm familiar with Moore.
So it was the same language there that Moore evaluated and that Gonzalez evaluated when the Supreme Court in both instances found that Congress does not regulate the legitimate practice of medicine and that that is not an explicit authorization within the statute, but that that is an implicit factor in what the Controlled Substances Act, except, and this is the important part of Gonzalez, the important part of the cannabis buyers case that the government relies upon, and an important part of the Moore case, except where Congress has said so explicitly. And I'll read to you just for a moment from Oregon. It says, when Congress wants to regulate medical practice in a given scheme, it does so by explicit language in the statute. And beyond that, the statute manifests no intent to regulate the practice of medicine generally. And so, but that the reason we put it under that portion of the text was because that was where it derived from Moore, and then that was the principle that was articulated
Let me ask you the threshold question I asked the government then. Is it Safe House's position that either in 1986 or 2003, Congress contemplated safe injection sites? And wouldn't they have had to if your authorized argument has merit? And I don't think they did.
Well, you know, what I do think that Congress contemplated is they did contemplate what the scope of appropriate medical care could be. And Congress articulated a scheme that is detailed in an extraordinary measure as to the do's and don'ts for medical practitioners in expressly enumerated regimes. And so it regulated medical practice in a very intentional way. And what the Supreme Court held is where it doesn't say that a doctor can't do something, a doctor can do those things within good faith, legitimate medical practice. And that's the standard that not only the Supreme Court articulated, but that juries, day in and day out, are applying when it comes to trials of doctors who are allegedly engaged in pill mills or illegal drug distribution. And so Congress did contemplate what doctors can and can't do. And
well, in Gonzales, the Supreme Court was addressing an affirmative regulation of medical practice. And that's really not the situation we have here. We have the government saying there's a criminal statute that bars the activity. I'm still having difficulty seeing where this is either authorized or fits within the Gonzales.
So there's two parts to the Gonzales decision. The first part talks about the scheme as a whole, and that's where I think the important piece of this puzzle comes in, because the court criticized the Department of Justice for arguing that the Attorney General could impliedly criminalize physician-assisted suicide where the statute and the regulations hadn't expressly done so. We think the case is even stronger here. In that case, the doctor was actually prescribing a controlled substance for an activity that the government deemed to be improper. Here, none of the activities that are regulated by the Controlled Substances Act are going to be performed by Safe House at all. There's no dispensing, administering, prescribing, storing, or distributing drugs by Safe House at all.
But on your premises, they would be using those prohibited drugs.
There would be using, which is not, I might add, a prohibited act under the statute, but possession is something that we're not doing. There's no way in which we could reasonably be interpreted to be, let's say, in constructive possession of the drugs that are in the participants' pockets. So what the government wants to do is impute whatever criminal liability might follow from the people who are benefiting from Safe House's services. They want to impute the criminal liability to us simply because they're on our premises.
And let's go back to the idea of medical practice, right? I mean,
yes.
Safe injection sites are certainly contemplated in the medical literature.
Yes.
But as I understand it, there has been no state board and there has been no medical professional board that has reported to prescribe standards for the operation of safe injection sites. Is that accurate?
I don't think it's entirely accurate, Your Honor, because recently the Philadelphia Board of Health passed a resolution endorsing the operation and institution of safe injection sites in overdose prevention cities.
From a regulatory scheme within the profession that would deal with the standards for this type of activity. So, I mean, again, I understand that in the literature, and I understand as well that among some medical associations, there's an evolution toward harm reduction strategies and whether this is appropriate. But in terms of regulated medical practice in safe injection sites, at least as far as I can tell, there isn't.
But, Your Honor, what Safe House is going to be doing is really no different than what occurs every day when an EMS person appears at the scene and is called to the scene, when an emergency medicine physician is presented with someone who is...
On the resuscitation end, it's no different.
Right. But all that is happening that is different today, that would be different under Safe House's proposal than what happens today, I should say, is that instead of walking out the door from the syringe exchange after receiving clean consumption equipment, the person is simply allowed to stay in the close proximity of someone with naloxone and training to administer it and provide respiratory support.
And when you say all that happens, the government's response would be yes, but that all that happens falls within the literal term of the statute.
Right, and so the question there is, does it fall within the terms of the statute? So one reason we think it doesn't fall within the terms of the statute is that not only our purpose, but our actual activities are directed at providing medical care, and as Your Honor pointed out, opportunities at every turn for medical treatment. And I wanted to say a word about that because the government seemed to doubt the idea that we're offering treatment and that treatment is a goal. In their own pleadings, they attach as an Exhibit A our website, which specifies not only the treatment options that will be given, but also the fact that there is no evidence that offering medically supervised consumption increases the use or rate of use of controlled substances. So and their pleadings incorporate that standard, and we certainly agree with them, as well as the not only the testimony, but what's been recently incorporated into the record in Exhibit 1 certainly makes that clear, if it wasn't clear from their pleadings in the first instance.
All right. I want to get off of as authorized. Other than the comment, I think the most you can hope for is that it's not prohibited. I'm still having difficulty with the except as authorized. Let me turn to unlawful use, because you argue that this can't apply because the statute doesn't apply, rather define the term unlawfully using. And again, it, just taking an ordinary meaning approach, isn't it fairly clear that individuals who would be injecting in a consumption room, they themselves would be unlawfully using?
Look, I'm not gonna fight too hard on that point, but I think that the fact that using is not one of the prohibited acts in the Controlled Substances Act does make, I mean,
you can't use unless you possess.
Well, Your Honor, that's not entirely true. You can possess, but you're not necessarily possessing unlawfully, because there's plenty of circumstances. For example, if somebody had a prescription, right, and they were in entirely unlawful possession of the prescription, let's say it wasn't, they were carrying it home for their husband or their wife, right, and then they decide, actually, at the last minute, I'm going to use this substance. They never were unlawfully possessing the substance, but they may have unlawfully consumed the substance.
Well, they were in the instance that they converted it to their own use, I think is what the government
right. argued. I don't think we need to address that metaphysical problem, but I think...
Well, I'm just having trouble. Yes. I don't see any real ambiguity in unlawfully using.
This is where I think the ambiguity comes in, and I think it goes to what is the core issue of the statute, and why was 856 passed to include unlawful use when it's not a prohibited activity? Because that to me is really the question that's raised by, you don't have unlawful using as something that's a defined term in the statute. So why did Congress throw it into 856? And I think that it goes to what is the core concern of Congress when it passed the statute. And this, when I talk about legislative history, I'm not just talking about Senator Biden's statement, which, by the way, are helpful, but also the interpretation looking at the statute's text and its role in the Controlled Substances Act, and why it adds to, for example, drug conspiracy and drug possession and drug distribution offenses. And the courts that have analyzed it have said Congress intended to criminalize the use of property for narcotics distribution, and that it's more than just the simple use or casual use at a property. And court after court, the courts that in some cases the government cites have rejected the idea that simple consumption is enough. Because
but
they were
incidental use is not enough, and the government would say what you have here would not be incidental use. The government would say Safe House is inviting use on a continued basis.
So we disagree with that point of view, because I think in some senses the only reason that use is being permitted on the premises is to enable the proximity to medical care and treatment. So it is incidental in the sense of the idea is not to promote, facilitate, encourage the use itself. It's to encourage the ability to be resuscitated, saved, and treated at the time and immediately after the use. But when Congress enacted, why did it include use? When it enacted Section 856, it had in mind, if you think about the prototypical opium den or crack house that it had in mind back in the 80s when it enacted this statute, these houses were congregating users as part of the drug operation to create, if you will, a market for dealers and others who were operating drug houses. So that it was, even if profit wasn't explicitly an element of the statute, that's the core of why Congress went after use and not just other distribution activities in the statute.
Okay, so if you say we need a definition of unlawful use, what's your definition of unlawful use?
My definition is tied. I don't dispute the fact that if someone is using drugs that they possess illegally, that that's unlawful use. But where I think the limiting principle comes in the statute is when you combine that with what the for the purpose of, you put those together. And what courts have said is when it comes to use, and that's why I think they've required what I would say is a plus factor in use cases, and actually there are really no use cases, and that's another point I'd like to get to in a minute, which is we've scoured, or I'll get to it now, which is we have scoured the records of the federal records and federal published cases, and in 33 years, we have never found a case where the government has prosecuted a case involving pure use. And the government has pointed to none. So the prosecutorial history suggests that they don't think that just personal consumption cases where there's no distribution activity, where there's no manufacturing activity, beyond just somebody using any property, that the government has never prosecuted such a case.
I know you're asking something, but under what federal statute would they prosecute unlawful use as compared to unlawful
the use of a property. What I'm saying is they've never used 856. They've never gone and found a group of people who are using an apartment to use drugs and prosecuted under 856. They've never gone to any other location. They haven't, you know, they've looked at rave parties, for example, which is under the 2003 statute. But how does a rave party differ from your everyday rock and roll concert that we know is excluded from the statute? It has to do with the degree and the reason for the use. And the use, what I call the plus factor, is that simple consumption, even where the owner, the operator, or the manager or controller knows about the simple consumption, they see the clouds of smoke, they know what's going on, that's not enough. That is not enough under multiple courts of appeals decisions. And there's a reason for that, because that would have no limiting principle under the statute. So I think when you combine unlawful use with for the purpose, it becomes clear that when there's a use case, there has to be something more.
That's a different argument than saying the statute can't be applied because unlawfully using is not defined. So that goes more to context, and you're mirroring some of the government's argument that you look at these words in combination with the other words. With respect to the contention that the use is incidental, say in the first 3 months of operation, if no one used the safe consumption rooms, would that make the project a failure?
I think it wouldn't, because hopefully that meant that people were coming to Safe House. I mean, if no one came to, it's a public health intervention, so if no one avails themselves of the opportunity to get care there, then it is not effective in that sense. But at the outset of someone's arrival, the hope is that they never would reach the supervised consumption room. The hope is that they come to the registration desk and they go right in to treatment, or they get the other types of medical care that they need, and that they never reach that place where they need to be part of the supervised consumption site. Unfortunately, in the case of people suffering from opioid use disorder, that's just not realistic in terms of the statistics for the vast majority of people who are suffering from the type of addiction that this service is designed to serve.
All right, we've been skirting around purpose. I'd like to move to purpose under A2 now. And you argue at one point in your brief that it's the property's purpose that controls. And how can the property have a purpose? Isn't it the possessor or the owner that has to have the purpose? I'm having difficulty, again, conceptualizing how this inanimate object has the purpose.
Right. So, look, I think that there is two facets to the statute. There's the mens rea, which Your Honor is focused on with respect to both A1 and A2, which is knowingly with A1 and knowingly intentionally with A2. And then there's a place for the purpose of. And in our view, that you're right that in some respects, purpose is something driven by people, but it's not exclusively driven by people. For example, if you were to walk into this courtroom and there were no people in it, you would readily discern that this was a place for the purpose of holding court. You would know that because of the way it's set up and what it's designed to do. And in the same respect, if you were to walk into Safe House, you would see that it is a place designed for the purpose of providing medical care, because you would see all of the medical equipment and the rows of naloxone and the defibrillator and the oxygen resuscitation.
Isn't that just a factor relevant to a determination of purpose rather than a technical statutory argument that the purpose only applies to the place? Because clearly, if you have a rave is often in a warehouse. And so, to take a prototypical example from 2003, and during the day the warehouse may have one use, and then at night it turns into a drug-infested party scene on a persistent basis, right? So there, you would have a nondescript purpose not tied uniquely to the use of narcotics.
Right, and I think the way that Your Honor put it when, and some of the courts have put it this way, is what is the purpose to which the premises is put? And I think is a good way to put it, because it's not exclusively driven by the people who enter that property. It is also driven by the features of how the facility is set up itself. So I think that in that sense, it is important to look at both factors. And I think I would also point out that, you know, I agree with Your Honor's analysis entirely, that when you look at the same language in the statute, place for the purpose of, that it has the same meaning in both instances. And I think our reading, which is the premises being put to criminal use, is really the key question as to the purpose of prong. And under the government's reading, the government would like us to read this statute, A2, to criminalize any time someone manages or opens a property or operates a property and knows that there's drug use going on. Knows that, because every time there's drug use going on, presumably the person using the drugs had the purpose of using it in that place. Well, that reads for the purpose, place for the purpose of, directly out of the statute. So not only, the other canon of statutory interpretation is you do have to give every piece meaning, and the government's interpretation would make that piece, the purpose piece, devoid of meaning. And I think purpose takes on particular importance when you're talking about a medical intervention. And I think it takes on particular significance when you're talking about personal consumption. Because I can just go through the courts here, because they are so strong on the fact that in Lancaster, for example, it said Section 856 cannot reasonably be construed to criminalize simple consumption of drugs in one's home. Stettler said that you must have evidence beyond manufacture for personal use to sustain a conviction. And Russell, which is 2010, which is the Sixth Circuit, each court to have addressed the issue has agreed that the casual user does not run afoul of 856 because he doesn't maintain his house for the purpose of drug use, but rather for the purpose of a residence. So they've made those distinctions, those additional distinctions in terms of what for the purpose of, in the context of use, to create a limiting principle in the statute, one that is rationally applied and that can provide notice to people who are trying to conform to the statute, but also to make clear that you're not going to have liability every time you simply know that someone who is simply using on the property is there.
When the government say you're constructing a facility with a consumption room specifically designed to be a consumption room, and that takes us beyond the casual use in a residence, what would your response be to that?
So I think that it is not a residency and it is not casual, but it is personal consumption. And I think that the additional facet of having simply clean tables and a sterile location isn't facilitating the use in any greater way than is already in existence in current programs. We're already providing all of the consumption equipment through federally endorsed syringe exchange programs. And right now we have to show people the door. The only difference between our proposal and what exists under federally endorsed scheme is that we're allowing people to stay within our facility. So I dispute a little bit about the idea that we're inviting people for drug use. I think we are inviting people to stay in order to be proximate even at the time of drug use.
Well, let me test the proposition that provision of medical support and resuscitation takes it outside the statute. But we'll get back to the famous Wayne and Garth of Saturday Night Live. And every Friday, they invite their friends over to shoot up and say, and it's a good place to come because we got naloxone right there. Regular event, and that's what they're doing. Statute apply.
So they invite their friends
right
for the purpose of using drugs.
But they're there with the naloxone. Does naloxone change the mix or not?
No, and I think that actually brings us to the safe stock example and is the sort of stark contrast between safe stock, which was the taboo medical tent, or the naloxone at the drug party that Wayne and Garth host, and what Safe reporting to do. Safe House is providing the type of medical services that would be available if someone showed up in the ER, or if an EMS or if an emergency medical personnel showed up on the street corner in somebody's house in response to an overdose. But they're allowing the proximity to someone who's already planning to use. They've taken the consumption equipment from the syringe exchange program. There's someone who has been known and registered and suffering from existing addiction. And the reason that we're allowing them to do that is not to have a party, is not for recreational use, is for the simple reason of being there to provide urgent life-saving care in the event of an overdose, rather than having to wait the critical minutes it would take if we had to run out behind a behind a closed door, or to run out into the street or blocks down to an unknown apartment.
And the government, I think, is saying, all right, to make the omelet, you need to break some eggs, and breaking the eggs, in this instance, consumption, is what violates the law. And so we agree you want to make an omelet, but a necessary step in between is unlawful. And then they go on to cite cases that say a noble motive does not excuse the violation of the law. So how does Safe House respond to that?
Yeah, well, it's not a noble motive here. Purpose is an element of the statute. So that's one of the critical differences. The cases they cite for purpose doesn't matter, like cases where
I'll grant you that.
Pardon?
They're heavily in the civil disobedience line of cases.
Well, they're more than civil disobedience. One of the cases was a case that they cite where a war protester goes in and destroys military equipment on a government facility for the purpose of saving lives. Well, that's nothing like what we're doing here. We're not engaging, in our view, in any illegal activity, because if you look at what is Safe House doing, what is the activities that Safe House is offering and the services that Safe House is offering, they are all directed at treatment, at life-saving care, and at providing primary medical care and social services to a vulnerable population in need. It's nothing, this is the activity that we're doing, is not that we're not consuming drugs, we're not destroying property. So I think that the motive there and the purpose, the aim and the objective are critically important, in part because of what the statute, in large part, because it's an element of the statute itself, and the government, an element that the government wants to read right out of the statute. So I think here, purpose is important, and I think that if you look at some of the concerns that the government suggested, well, a crack dealer could just say, well, my purpose isn't really dealing drugs, it's to provide for my family or to make money.
I'm sure to dismiss that as wordplay, but I don't dismiss the argument that an actual physical space which contemplates the use of drugs on a consistent basis could fall within the terms of the statute.
Right. And so I just want to point out that the concern that courts articulated with respect to these alternative purposes is that someone would propose a legitimate cover as a potential excuse or immunity from liability under the statute. You know, if they had a nightclub or a bar or a car dealership, that should inoculate the place against liability under the statute. But what we're offering here is very different. They can't doubt, particularly given that this is on the judgment for our pleadings, that this is, as the facts is pleaded, that this is designed to be a medical and public health intervention. And so this is not some kind of cover story for actually trying to secretly promote drug use where we're claiming that it's really a medical use.
I think I've covered most of the questions I wanted to cover, but are there other points that you want to make, Counsel?
There is an important point that I think we should cover, because it goes to how do you evaluate this statute, which is, you know, we've looked at the words of this statute, and we've looked at the words in part of the Convinces Act, and this also comes from the Gonzales, words in Gonzales about Congress is explicit when it wants to regulate medical practice. I think it's important of what Congress has done. So the U.S. Attorney described the CARA Act, which included federal funding for naloxone. And it awards federal grant money for entities providing naloxone treatment. It provides that they should, quote, maximize the availability of opioid receptor antagonists, including naloxone, to veterans. And it recognizes Good Samaritan statutes that provide immunity for people who provide naloxone. But here's the crux. Naloxone only works if there's somebody else there to administer it, somebody who is right there. Without Safe House, if naloxone is administered only by happenstance, if a first responder or a Good Samaritan or a Prevention Point staff member can run fast enough, can find the person quickly enough, is just by chance close by.
So let's take care and let's go back to the government's argument, and they would say, agreed, why don't you then say to Congress, let's amend CARA to deal with what we propose to do? What would your response to that be?
My response would be that there's no need to amend the statute to do what Congress has not prohibited. We are permitted to administer naloxone. We're permitted to provide critical medical care to people suffering from opioid use disorder, and Congress has recognized that opioid use disorder is a disease that needs treatment and intervention, particularly this intervention, which is naloxone. What we are doing is exactly what Congress has asked, has provided funding for, which is allowing individuals at high risk of overdose death to be in close proximity to the naloxone that it is funding. It would be ineffectual, and it is ineffectual, unfortunately, under the current system where we wait and respond. That's why, unfortunately, we have lost so many people in this crisis. What Safe House has purported to do is to close that gap, and it's really not a gap in the statute, Your Honor. It is a gap in care. It is a gap in care in the current model based on the fear of prosecution that has prevented us from closing that gap and providing naloxone when it is most urgently required.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McSwain, I think I've channeled many of the government's arguments in my questions to counsel for Safe House, but by all means, if you want to, and then I'll grant the same right to Safe House.
Just very briefly, Your Honor.
Certainly.
I think when you're looking at the statute, it's really important for us to be clear about how the statute here is not silent about the important points having to do with supposed medical use of heroin. Similar to, again, the Oakland cannabis case, here, what Safe House is purporting to do has been explicitly prohibited, again, based on the citations that I talked about in my first presentation, where Congress has said there is no medical use for marijuana. When Congress says no, it means no. So we're not in an implied situation. We're not in a situation where you have to try to guess at what Congress is saying. There is an explicit prohibition. Similarly, there's an explicit prohibition about using your place for the purpose of drugs. When they talk about, you know, this is the same as EMS. I mean, it's not the same as an EMS intervention. All that's different here is that you're actually using a place, which means, in other words, all that's different is you're actually violating a criminal statute. So it is an important additional step, a distinction that matters. That is the illegality. And then lastly, I would just say, it seems like Safe House is starting to try to change sort of on the fly what they're actually doing. I mean, let's be real. What they are doing is they're inviting people onto their property to use drugs. They're not inviting people onto their property just to get treatment or whatever other services they're offering. The whole purpose here is for people to use drugs. What's going to get people to come to Safe House as opposed to Prevention Point and other places? They can get all that other stuff at Prevention Point. The marketing, the important additional aspect to Safe House is come here and use the drugs. So when they say that they're not inviting people to use drugs, we're not facilitating drug use, talking about the purpose of the users is not necessarily to use drugs, I mean, that's just bizarro world. That's not reality. If this opens up, the whole point of it existing is for addicts to come and use drugs. So I don't think that we can obscure that fact by pointing to the other services that they will be providing. That's all I had, Your Honor, unless you had any questions for me.
You really were brief, Mr. McSwain. Thank you.
Thank you.
Size is done. Anything you wish to say in response?
No, Your Honor.
All right. I thank counsel for their briefing and presentation today. And as the saying goes, we'll take this case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.